You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis, filling in for Philip Yun. So, President Biden addressed Congress and the nation last week after a whirlwind 100 days in office. He talked about the pandemic, tackled the threats posed by Russia and China, and he focused on climate change, though only through a certain lens.
For too long, we've failed to use the most important word when it comes to meeting the climate crisis: jobs. Jobs.
You can see what he's doing here, right? Biden needs to sell climate action to a country that's deeply divided, and the future of the planet hangs in the balance. Biden promised to act fast on climate change, and that's exactly what he's done. In the past 3 months, he's rejoined the Paris Agreement and pledged to slash U.S. greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2030. His administration just hosted a global climate summit last month. But now comes the hard part. Biden is trying to tackle climate change through his ambitious $2 trillion infrastructure plan, which he also says will spur job creation and strengthen communities around the country. He needs to get it through Congress, and it's not clear that he will. So this week, we're revisiting a past hour about our climate future, its policy solutions, and what could happen if we fail. We're going to start with a hard look at Biden's policy vision and the legacy President Trump left behind. Last year, KQED's Scott Schaefer sat down with former California Governor Jerry Brown and oceanographer Sylvia Earle. They talked right after the presidential election, so you'll hear a few references to Biden's campaign and that sort of thing. And they also anticipate Biden's strategy and the challenges confronting it. Scott takes it from here.
Sylvia Earle is a pioneering oceanographer who's dedicated her life to preserving and protecting the oceans against human impacts like climate change and ocean acidification. She has logged more than 7,000 hours underwater, often introduced as her deepness, a living legend, and Time Magazine's first ever hero for the planet. Earle is former chief scientist for NOAA, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and is currently a National Geographic Explorer in residence. Through her nonprofit Mission Blue, she advocates for a worldwide network of marine protected areas. Sylvia Earle joins us from Oakland. Welcome.
Great to be on board.
And from Colusa County, Jerry Brown joins us too. From Secretary of State to Governor, to presidential candidate, Attorney General, Mayor, and Governor again, Jerry Brown's political career in California has spanned 50 years. Among the many issues he prioritized during his tenure as governor was climate change. Under his leadership, California banded together with leaders from around the world to commit to cutting carbon emissions. The state is on track to generate 100% of its electricity from renewable sources and achieve carbon neutrality. Jerry Brown currently serves as chair of the California-China Climate Institute housed at UC Berkeley. Welcome, Governor Brown.
Thank you.
Well, we have just gone through an extraordinary election where two presidential candidates had pretty much diametrically opposed views on climate change. Governor, starting with you, what do you make, first of all, of the amount of time that was spent talking about climate change during the campaign and the way it was talked about?
Well, I'm impressed that climate change was talked about in this campaign more than any other campaign in American history. That's point one. Point two, the amount of debate and exploration of the topic is inadequate, totally inadequate to the challenge that America and the world is facing. Third point would be that Joe Biden has a plan which he finances in his proposal by a $2 trillion investment. That's the biggest ever, and it's certainly at the level that is required, at least starting off. So I would say that is a very, very positive set of developments.
Dr. Earle, what would you add to that? Did the election leave you feeling hopeful?
Yes, I'll add an exclamation point to Governor Brown's comments. What was I think most striking is that it was so prominently evident in the Biden campaign and so prominently absent from the other side. Climate change, it's not debatable, it's real. It's a matter of recognizing it as such and then acting on what we know now that we could not know 50 years ago. We have evidence, and it's compelling.
What did Donald Trump do as president? Of course, he's not done being president yet. But Dr. Earle, what do you think he has done in terms of undermining science and the environment that is the longest lasting, that will have the longest lasting impact?
Creating an atmosphere of doubt. For scientists, it's really puzzling. The evidence is there for anyone to see. But by raising that element of doubt, people are given an option. And complacency sets in, which is probably the biggest problem. We need urgency, not complacency. We know what to do. It's a matter of really getting about the business of acting. And when you have people who say, well, maybe yes, maybe no, that's the problem.
Governor Brown, who can undo that doubt that has been sowed, not just around climate change, but, you know, even at least as much around the pandemic?
The scientists themselves and the new groups of people that Biden will bring in, and the debate and the speeches and the back and forth that will now take place. I would say that Trump is actually, by his perversity and his quixotic and bizarre behavior, is actually setting a foundation for a more serious engagement with the science on both the virus and climate change. He's given climate skepticism and virus skepticism a very bad name by his antics, by his overblown presentations. So yes, for a moment, for these last 4 years, we've had this growing discord, disaffection or disbelief in science on the part of tens of millions of Americans. That's all true. But because the Trump presentation is so deviant to the norm, I believe it will be swept away quickly. And Biden and the people that he bring in, and also the Congress, as it grapples with the facts on the ground, with the virus running out of control right now, with climate change continuing to make its path through our society, through the planet. All that is going to be the occasion for a more intelligent response. And fortunately, we have in Joe Biden an intelligent, reasonable person who can help us grow up and face the facts as we know them to be.
One of the things, of course, that the Trump administration has done is to withdraw from a wide range of treaties, including the Paris Agreement. Dr. Earle, when you talk with scientists and others around the world, what do you hear about how that loss of leadership and that voice from the United States, what impact has that had?
Well, the rest of the world has kept on keeping on, fortunately. And one of the most positive things happening right now is the role of the ocean is being acknowledged. When the climate change conference was scheduled to be in Chile, the president of Chile called it the Blue COP for the first time, really putting the role of the ocean and ocean chemistry front and center. And it will happen again in Scotland when the next conference does take place. That's one of the things that has evolved in recent decades. It's not just about the atmosphere, but it's the connection between the ocean and the atmosphere. And that's exciting. It didn't originate so much in this country, although the science certainly had a strong push from this country, but around the world, recognizing that the whole planet is connected, and that what we're doing to the ocean, as well as what we're doing to the atmosphere, is having a significant impact on climate.
And I do want to come back to the role that the oceans play. But Governor, I'm wondering, you know, to what extent you do a lot of work with China. To what extent has China filled the void, for better or worse, or better and worse, perhaps, now that the United States has receded a bit from this conversation?
China has set a goal, 2060, too late in the judgment of most scientists, but nevertheless, they set a goal. They set a goal of carbon neutrality. That's radical. No one in the Trump administration or in Congress has done that to this point. So China is leading to that extent. But I don't think there's any filling of the void. If by void you mean the absence of the kind of decisive, comprehensive action needed, that's self-evident. That's what's going on in the world. And China has to step up further. The United States has to join the rest of the world, rejoin the Paris Agreement, and get going. And the resistance by the oil industry, the coal industry, the gas industry, the automobile industry, and all the other industries that are based on the fossil fuel predicate have to come around. And bringing them around will be the great challenge. And I think Joe Biden can definitely take us a long way in that regard. And President Xi is facing the same thing. The Communist Party, like the Congress, will face fossil fuel interests. And overcoming that will take diplomacy, pressure, and greater enlightenment than now currently obtains in the world.
The issue of fracking is one that you confronted as governor. There were people who felt that you didn't act decisively enough to stop fracking. It was a great focus of the second debate between Biden and Trump. And I'm just wondering, did that conversation, what did you learn from the way that whole issue was handled and the way that conversation went?
Fracking is one of the modes of extracting oil. Extracting oil causes pollution. It also undergirds the entire economy of America and the world. Californians use 18 billion, B as in billion, gallons of gasoline and diesel every year. They're going to continue doing that, hopefully with a downward slope, so we eventually get to zero or some kind of net zero. All right? So fracking is a very tiny subset of the overall oil drilling in California. It's a larger phenomenon in Texas and in Pennsylvania. The polluting effects derive from exposing fossil fuel to the environment. That's where it comes from. Dropping the chemicals that break up rock in the fracking process is relatively trivial compared to the overall pollution of the oil production and, of course, the effects on climate. So we have to attack the larger problem, and you do it in a sequence of actions. There is no magic bullet where you say, stop X, and you made some leap forward. You have to stop sequentially until finally you get to net zero. And you do that by reducing consumption so people don't use 18 billion gallons of gasoline and diesel in California. You've got to stop the use. Otherwise, if you stop a fracking of oil in California, then imports will increase. Most of the oil in California, the gasoline, derives from foreign or sources outside the state, 70%. So you stop fracking, then we'll import 3% more at 73 or 74%. Pennsylvania, it's a much bigger deal, but we all agree we must reduce it, but at what pace? You can't turn it off or you stop the entire economy, and no one's going to do that. If you even tried, there'd be such a backlash that you'd go way beyond in the opposite direction of what you wanted. So fracking is an organizing flag that people can wave. But the truth is, Joe Biden did not wave it, nor did I, because the hard work of reducing and eliminating carbon emissions does not lie in a single act, a single bold move in response to a climate organizing campaign. That's a campaign that needs a phrase, stop fracking, two words. But what is needed to get to zero carbon emission is thousands of pages of very discrete and minute plans that are going to take the world and America off of fossil fuel and get us on to 100% renewable. And wow, that's heroic. That's huge. And we don't even know how we're going to completely do it. The key point is get doing it. Let's get on with it. And the climate activists, good, they push us, they get our awareness up, but that is not a plan. The plan in California, which we're so proud of, is a very detailed scoping plan that's very complicated, forceful, it's coercive, and it's what we do. But that plan itself has to be revised every 2 years and will continuously improve as the years go on in taking us to this net zero carbon.
Dr. Earle, there's a lot of focus, of course, on what government can do. Joe Biden, as we've said, has a very ambitious plan, but now there are big questions about what he could actually get done through the Senate. And I'm wondering, how do you think government or, you know, nonprofit and scientific communities can work together? You, Dr. Earle, work very closely with the Obama administration on the massive expansion of a marine national monument in Hawaii. I think that's the largest marine conservation area. Yes. So what lessons can be learned from that and the work that you're doing with the Mission Blue Foundation?
Well, providing evidence. You know, nature doesn't lie. Rachel Carson said, you can't repeal the laws of nature. You have to make peace with nature. You have to understand what's there. You need the facts. You need to respect the reality. And I think part of the role, the biggest role for science and what we're doing with Mission Blue is to communicate the reality and to respect not just how we can reduce carbon emissions and get at the global climate change from that direction, but also to protect the natural systems that have created a planet that works in our favor. It's taken 4.5 billion years to get us in a universe of really hostile options. I mean, I don't want to live on Mars, even if I could. I want to live here. It's taken us about 4.5 decades to significantly unravel those very systems that have taken so long to create a stable environment, relatively stable, suitable for us. We've undone so much with the destruction of the natural systems on the land as well as in the ocean. You know, we see half the coral reefs already gone or in a state of decline, partly because of the warming trend, but also because we've taken so much out of the ocean. Coral reef is not just about the coral, it's about the fish too. It's about the whole system. And so protecting as much of the natural integrity of the planet, restoring what we can. Here in California, having this network of protected areas within state waters really sets a standard for others, but we need to do a lot more and to work on the federal level and the international level, the high seas, half the world, to respect the natural climate governing processes and work within that framework.
You've described the loss of sea life and coral as paradise lost, and I'm wondering, is there a way, in addition to whatever protection and prevention can be done, is there such a thing as building resilience into the ocean?
Well, it starts with looking at those places that are already in good shape and not letting them degrade further. They serve as a source of restoration for places that have been depleted or damaged. And we know where those places are. Here in California, we've got a good start with this network of small but really important, fully protected areas. But we need to scale up both in state waters, but also in our exclusive economic zones that are around the world. But right now, there's a chance by looking at the part of the planet that everybody uses. That's the high seas. It's like the atmosphere above. It's the global commons. It is disproportionately being torn apart by a handful of nations with subsidies that really encourage high seas fishing, for example. We need to think about what we can do quickly in the next 10 years We need to get off the fossil fuel train, of course. But meanwhile, there's some really important things we can do by looking at what we can do to restore health to the natural systems that generate oxygen, take up carbon dioxide, maintain the integrity of the diversity of life. And that's what we're trying to support, what we're encouraging through not just Mission Blue, but there are organizations around the world that are now coming together to speak for nature. It's the best hope we've got.
Governor, you have embraced technology going all the way back to the 1970s. I think it earned you the moniker Governor Moonbeam, which you've embraced. What is the role for technology? I think some people hold out this notion that, well, we don't really have to cut carbon emissions because technology is going to figure it out. There'll be like a vaccine, you know, for climate change.
Technology is crucial. Technology got us where we are, and it has to be continuously employed to get us into a better position. So whether it's electric storage with batteries, whether it's the generation of power on a non-renewable basis, whether it's different materials that we can use and different ways that we're producing our food and other things that we all need, that's all going to take innovation. It's going to take technology and science and very skillful means going forward. So there's no way around that. Of course, I think we're going to have to, we're going to have to change some of our habits and make human presence on the earth more compatible with the laws of nature. And the laws of nature do what they do, and they're headed to cause a lot of trouble in the ocean, in the air, on the land, if a humankind doesn't tread more in line with the rules of physics so that we don't create so much negative to ourselves and other species.
This will, you know, set the hair on fire for a lot of environmentalists, but what about nuclear energy? We know that it doesn't contribute to global warming. Is there a role for that, or is that just a non-starter?
Well, nuclear energy is a complex technology, and I'm not a nuclear scientist or technician or engineer. It definitely is a pathway that is now being pursued. It is generating electricity in California and many countries of the world. So look, they say, some people say, Bill Gates invests in many companies that are working on a better nuclear technology. So I definitely wouldn't rule that out. But I would point to the problem that we're still having trouble storing the waste. Some people say that's not going to be a big problem, but we haven't got to a satisfactory solution yet. Number two, the more nuclear engineers and technology we spread around the world, the more people we have that are capable of building weapons. And thirdly, the existing nuclear plants are very inviting targets for terrorists. So there's lots of issues there, but it is a technology that some people see with a lot of promise going forward.
We here in California, of course, cannot deny the impact of climate change with the wildfires and everything else, the heat, the dryness, the lack of water. As someone who focuses on the ocean, Dr. Earle, do you find that people living either near coasts or on islands are more aware and appreciative of what's happening to the climate and to our planet?
Well, island countries, I think, and coastal communities experience the impact of climate change perhaps disproportionately. At least they're more aware of it as sea level rises, as storms increase. And island nations now are coming into their own, not just because of their sensitivity to climate change, but because they, with the laws that we've created, that give them jurisdiction over the ocean in a magnified way. Little island country of Palau has a little bit of land, but a lot of ocean. And that's true of all of these so-called small island nations, are big ocean nations. And they're using their voice and feeling their power, as they should, because they are overwhelmed in many ways by the big countries. But they have a strong voice when it comes to the ocean. And as the ocean really becomes a more powerful part, or acknowledged as a more powerful part of climate change, their voices will be increasingly powerful as well.
I want to ask each of you a sort of a personal question. You're both in your 80s. And I'm wondering, you know, what have you learned about your own resilience that you think is relevant to the earth? And I'll start with you, Governor.
I don't know that I've learned anything about my resilience that's relevant to the earth. I don't think the earth gives a damn about my resilience or lack thereof. The world is, if you talk about the world, if you talk about nature, the carbon cycle, the hydrogen cycle, hydrological cycle, it's just going. So what can I say? We know we have to sleep, and we know we have to get up. We know we get sick, and most of the time we recover until we don't, and then we're dead. So I don't know. We're human, we're mortal, and therefore we've got to be very sensitive to the way we work and the way the world works.
I think I hear, is that Cali or Calusa that I hear there?
That's Cali.
I thought so.
There's someone coming by, and these are watchdogs, and they're barking till they finally work it out with the new business.
Okay. Meanwhile, Dr. Earl, what about you? What have you learned? What kind of wisdom that you've gotten with age that you think is relevant?
Well, kids today are faced with what appear to be just overwhelming reasons for despair. And I tell them, no, you know, if you could be born anywhere in time, choose now, because now we know what could not be known when I was a child. No one had been up in the sky far enough away to look back and see Earth as this little blue miracle in the vastness of the universe. I mean, even Einstein could not see what 10-year-olds of today grow up with. He hadn't seen through the eyes of astronauts that amazing catalytic vision of who we are and where we've come from, where we might be going. In my personal perspective, I've been a witness. I think if I have power that's useful, and I think Governor Brown, for you, with your perspective, as a witness to the greatest time of change, the greatest opportunity that we will ever have is right about now, because now we know what could not be known 50 years ago, 100 years ago, any time in the past. And leaping forward another 50 years, we can look back at this time as pivotal. What we do or what we fail to do right now has a magnified greater than any time in the past or perhaps any time in the future. We still have options. Whether we act on them positively or whether we fail to will determine whether the kids in the future are saying, what, you knew and you didn't do anything? What were you thinking? Or they'll say, thank you, thank you, thank you, because you got it just in time.
Governor, all your decades in public service and public life, and you run a lot of campaigns, mostly successful, some unsuccessful. In terms of what you've learned from politics, what do you think, how hopeful are you that, we can convince enough people on this planet to do what it's going to take to get climate change under control?
Well, I'm hopeful because hope is a virtue and we like to pursue virtue whenever we can. But I have no idea what the future entails. It is exciting at one level because of all the different discoveries and the technologies that are now available to us and will become available. But where it all goes, that depends on fallible human beings. And the fallible human beings that have been driven by desire, endless desire, now have the capability of destroying humanity, civilization. With climate change, with nuclear, possibly with some kind of bioengineered nightmare. So the risk level, the danger level is much, much higher. Unimaginably higher. So there's where we are. But by the same token, there are tremendous scientific resources, and there's still human beings that can make hopefully good decisions. But there's nothing guaranteed. And I like the text of St. Paul, who said, we work out our salvation in fear and trembling. And I don't think that's a bad attitude to combine with zest and will and some kind of optimism to drive us forward.
All right, well, that's a pretty good place to leave it. Governor Jerry Brown and Dr. Sylvia Earle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis. If you want to hear more of this program or any other episode, you can download our podcast at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for World Affairs. That's one word. Zero carbon emissions, restoring lost ecosystems, technological advancements we can only dream of. These policy actions are tough, but they're manageable. They also can't come soon enough.
Now to the evacuations tonight, the wildfire emergency in the West.
At least 100 people are dead and thousands more have been evacuated after Tropical Depression Eta slammed into Central America.
According to the Institute for Economics and Peace, climate change could displace over a billion people in the next 30 years. And that displacement has already started, including in the United States. Ray Suarez takes it from here.
Paradise, California is a sleepy town ringed by pine trees in the foothills of the Sierra Mountains. On November 8, 2018, residents woke up to high winds and watched the sky turn yellow as they drove to work. Harmony von Stockhausen was a senior at Paradise High School.
I went to school and these boys told me, oh, school's canceled, like you can leave. I'm like, oh, why? And they're like, oh, there's just a fire up on the ridge. And then all of a sudden, it was kind of like a panic. Oh my gosh, grab your stuff, grab whatever you can.
Mandatory evacuation to all of Paradise. Get people moving now.
Oh my gosh,
we are stuck in it.
It's hot.
Hot right now.
Over the course of the day, the Camp Fire grew into the deadliest wildfire in California history. It leveled the entire town of Paradise in a matter of hours. Harmony evacuated with her mother and grandmother.
Traffic was so bad, you couldn't. Me and my mom lived 5 minutes away from my grandma, and it took us an hour to get to our house.
86 people died as they tried to flee the area. Some people ran out of gas or burned up in their cars. Nearly 30,000 more people were displaced by the Camp Fire. And 2 years later, Paradise is still struggling to recover. Many residents are determined to rebuild, but last September, the community was urged to evacuate twice in a matter of weeks as wildfires burned closer to them. Harmony von Stockhausen is now a sophomore at San Francisco State. She's also featured in Last Days at Paradise High, a documentary produced by Emily Thomas and Derek Knowles.
Prom is coming. Mark your calendars for Saturday, May 18th at Manzanita.
The film follows Harmony and her classmates as they get ready to graduate, grapple with losing their homes, and face the uncertain climate future ahead of them. I interviewed Harmony and filmmaker Emily Thomas in September, right after Paradise's most recent evacuation warning had been lifted. Welcome to you both. Harmony, let me start with you. Where are you living now, and have you been keeping close watch on the latest fires?
Hi, and so I'm living in Chico, California now, and I am actually very close to the current fires. The smoke was pretty intense, and there was ash falling again. And as soon as I saw the smoke and the ash coming down again, I was like, I want to leave. I want to get out of here. And people were telling me it's not going to reach Chico. It's not going to reach Paradise. It'll be okay. But it's just like that panic within myself was like, I can't deal with this again. Like, I just want to get out.
Did your family go back to Paradise after the devastating fire there in 2018?
My mom is rebuilding currently, and she is going back to Paradise and is in the process right now.
How do you feel about that?
I told her I could never go back. I could never move back to Paradise and live there normally as I did before. But for her, I know she needs that feeling of home. That was her home for so long, and she needs to hold on to that. So I can understand for her that she needs to go back, because that is her home. That's where she's meant to die. That's where she's meant to live her life.
Emily Thomas, the film is moving, beautiful, sad, and sometimes very encouraging. These kids were heavily marked by their experience, not exactly happy-go-lucky teenagers, were they?
Yeah, I think over the duration of filming, we really saw, I'd say towards the end, more of the effects of the fire start to show in the students and the kids.
You can't really understand what we went through unless you, like, were escaping that day.
I've come to the conclusion that nothing is permanent. And, you know, that's something I have to accept. And if I accept it now, it'll be less devastating later.
I think a lot of times trauma happens delayed. And yeah, I think coming of age is hard for everyone. But, you know, add losing your town to that. And then their first year in college, a global pandemic to the mix. They've been through a lot in the past couple years. I think Harmony, you know, kind of had a very strong facade throughout the whole time. And we were always kind of wondering, you know, how are you feeling inside? Because she does a great job of concealing, I think, that. But I think a lot of it might have hit her later on, what had happened. And then other kids had blow-ups in the middle of class and, you know, were more violent or angry. And I think, anger and emotions unfold for everyone in very drastically different ways.
Is that right, Harmony? Did this experience unfold for you over time?
Definitely. With Emily and Derek, I definitely put up this facade. I like to put out this happy, like, not sad person just because it's just the way I am. But soon after, I've started having a lot of anxiety. Like, say I had a big important term paper due and I couldn't get it exactly the way I wanted it to, I'd have this weird panic attack. Instead of just dealing with it and moving forward, I would like stress about it so hard that I'd freak out. And I think that is definitely part of PTSD from the fire. Instead of dealing with my issues, I kind of just want to explode. When I first left for college, I was, you know, upbeat, excited, very positive. And I visited home for, I think, Thanksgiving break. And then I went back and I just had this weird feeling of depression. I'm like, I shouldn't be sad anymore. I should be fine. I should be okay. But then I realized I shouldn't be okay. Like, it's okay to continue mourning. And I stay close to a lot of people because they're my class. They're my friends. And a lot of my friends, I feel like, went through the ringer. They developed really bad anxiety issues and depression. And while others are left for college and are doing great, others really got in this low set of mind. And but they're growing, they're doing their best, and that's all I can hope for. But I'm definitely staying connected to a lot of people in my senior class. I love all those kids. They're all great.
Emily, you've been watching this story unfold in California. Are you becoming convinced, worried, that there are parts of California where people just shouldn't live? They're too fragile, they're too dangerous, too hard to protect?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a tough question. You know, I think Californians take the risks to live in these beautiful places, knowing that, you know, we face wildfires. The big one's coming any day, and it keeps me up at night. I'm terrified of it. But, and personally, I am planning to probably move out of California. I think this past year has just really, you know, kind of ingrained that it's going to keep getting worse, and it's pretty scary.
And Harmony, you mentioned earlier that you wouldn't go back to your old hometown, but are you thinking differently about California's future now?
Yeah, like Emily said, as soon as I'm done with my education, I want to get out of California just because I don't want to have to go through such a traumatic experience again. And not only that, but it's just the little things, like I said, just like the ash and the smoke when the fire wasn't even close, had such a big effect on me that I just really don't want to have to deal with things like this again. It's really sad to say, though, because I love California otherwise.
Have the adults kind of let you down? I have a daughter who's 20, And I have this conversation with her sometimes. She's pretty annoyed about the indecision on doing anything about climate change, and basically says to me, you know, what kind of country is this going to be in when I'm 30, when I'm 40? Do you ever get that feeling?
I definitely get that feeling. It's really intense because my generation has so much like leaning on our shoulder because we are the ones who are supposed to be the change. We're the ones who are supposed to make that change. And if we don't, then there will be no Earth. Earth will be just gone. And so it's a lot. It's a lot upon our shoulders. But I think that it is our job, because if it isn't our job, then the Earth will be destroyed.
Filmmaker Emily Thomas and Harmony von Stockhausen, great to talk to you both. Good luck, and good luck with the decisions you have to make, Harmony.
Thanks so much, Ray.
Thank you.
Wildfires in the West are getting much worse because of climate change. But there are things we can do to make our country more resilient, because these wildfires are also fueled by decades of misguided rules and regulations. We've repeatedly built housing in fire zones, and federal and state agencies mismanaged our forests. And if bad policy makes climate disasters even more damaging, then maybe some creative decision makers can make them better. World Affairs CEO Philip Yun takes it from here with a segment he recorded last fall.
Juan Emmanuel Santos is used to tackling problems that seem impossible. When he was elected president of Colombia in 2010, he inherited one of the bloodiest problems of any statesman, a 45-year civil war. As president, Santos achieved what many thought was a lost cause, a peace treaty between the government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. They're better known as the FARC. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for that achievement. He also took on another crisis, climate change.
La afectación llegó al 90% de nuestro territorio.
Santos reached out to Colombia's native communities, arguing these groups are the best guardians of the Amazon's forest and waterways. In 2018, he signed a historic decree that strengthened indigenous control over native lands. During his time in office, Santos again became a compelling leader, this time on climate change, protecting large areas of land and creating the country's unique carbon tax. In late September, I spoke with Santos as part of the Global Philanthropy Forum, an annual event produced by World Affairs. President Santos, welcome to World Affairs.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored to participate, and I hope that we can give some good ideas of how to tackle the difficult but challenging future that we have.
You recently declared at the World Economic Forum that humanity, quote, humanity and nature are further out of alignment than ever before, end quote. From this statement and your writings and speeches, you clearly hold dear the idea that all people are connected to the earth organically. And within that context, you are outspoken about the need to incorporate the priorities of indigenous populations around the world, essentially social equity. So with the threats from declining biodiversity, more flooding from sea level rise, fires burning hotter and longer and more widespread, and even the global pandemic, these are all affecting the poor and the weak. More so. So what can the global community do in your mind to restore what you think is this balance?
Well, I learned from the indigenous communities when I first met them how important it is to understand precisely the connection with nature. And they gave me a perfect example. It was a river, very important river in Colombia, that was having a lot of problems, a lot of floods, wetlands that would be destroyed. And they showed me how, if you understand that the river has life and that it reacts to whatever the human being does to it, then you'll start respecting the river and respecting what surrounds the river. And that was a great lesson for me, because from there I understood the connection with other priorities that we should have today in terms of maintaining our biodiversity and fighting climate change. As a matter of fact, Colombia, we were the ones who proposed the SDGs back in the year 2012. And I took to the indigenous communities the SDGs, and I told them, look, this is something that has been done on your behalf, because they were the guardians of nature. And they studied the SDGs and said, well, we think that's a step in the right direction, but it's lacking something very important. And I said, what? And they said the spiritual component. The world needs to understand that all these SDGs, that all the objectives, you cannot only reach them if you feel in your inside that you're dealing with something that is at your same at the same level. And I asked them, what do you mean? And they very simply explained to me, the humans have tried to dominate nature, and that is a big mistake. Nature has to be treated as an equal, and you have to live with nature and live by the laws of nature. Otherwise, nature will get mad and will react. And I suffered that. I suffered that, and they advised me that I was going to suffer that. We had the worst Niña phenomenon about a month after they told me this. And they said, see, this is the way nature reacts when it feels that it's being mistreated. So that aspect, I think, is extremely important, that we need to understand that the trees have life, that the rivers have life, that nature is a basic component of our well-being, and that we have to treat nature with respect. And that, for me, was a great, great lesson.
So you mentioned the UN Sustainable Development Goals, or the SDGs. You've been a champion for those, and you've been working for many years on ways, using those as a way to eradicate poverty. And so can policies designed to eradicate poverty also impact climate in positive ways?
Oh, yes, there is a very clear connection, and I will give you a specific example. Colombia and also Brazil, we're having a tremendous problem with deforestation, which has a terrible impact on the world. And one of the causes of deforestation is poverty. So trying to fight poverty will impact directly the deforestation to lessen the rate of deforestation, or if possible, reverse it. And therefore, there is a connection. And there are ways more effective to fight poverty. We started in Colombia, there was the pilot project. Now about 60 countries have it, to measure poverty in a different way. The traditional way, the way that the World Bank and the IMF and many international organizations measure poverty, is by income. Well, there are many theories, and I mentioned specifically a former professor of mine, Amartya Sen, who afterwards won the Nobel Prize in Economics, that said, no, this is a wrong way to measure poverty. You have to measure poverty according to the basic needs of families, address those needs, and that will help you fight poverty in a more effective way. And I did that. And for the last 10 years, Colombia has been probably the country in the whole region, the whole of Latin America, where poverty and extreme poverty has been lowered the most, because it allowed the government to focus on those aspects that have the largest impact on fighting poverty. So that's a clear example.
Let's talk about climate change specifically. You kind of alluded to that just a few moments ago, but what is Colombia doing directly? What do you see are promising efforts that they're starting to use in order to mitigate?
Well, we are very vulnerable to climate change because we are one of the richest countries in terms of biodiversity. We are the most biodiverse country per square kilometer in the whole planet. So biodiversity affects us very much. And we started protecting the biodiversity by enlarging the protected areas of the country where the biodiversity is concentrated, and also giving the indigenous communities a much more important role in protecting the forest and the biodiversity. They are really ideal partners in that venture. And we have been not only protecting the areas inland, but also we have two oceans, the Atlantic, the Caribbean, and the Pacific. And there we have also very rich environment, and we have been protecting those areas. And we also put in place, it was the first country in Latin America, a carbon tax with a specific objective to finance what is needed for the protection of the protected areas to effectively work. Many countries have protected areas, but you go there and they're not really in practice protected. So we did that, and I think that is working quite well. We need to do a lot more to fight deforestation, and we have to continue doing something extremely important. We are a very rich country in oil and coal, and we have to change our paradigm to go into renewable energies. That takes a lot of persuasion because the economic incentive to continue producing coal and producing oil is very big, as you all know. And so there, the work of the world and of all the organizations to understand the importance of this change towards renewable energies is very, very important at this time, especially after the pandemic. If we want to build back better, I think that's one key aspect.
Well, speaking of the pandemic, which is something we obviously, you know, need to ask you about, and I think others want to know about the situation in Colombia sort of politically as well. So how is Colombia faring in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic? And is that affecting the peace negotiations and the discussions with the FARC that you worked on so hard during your 8 years as president?
Well, we are not doing very well with the pandemic. We started doing very well, but unfortunately, the rate of infection has been maintained, and we are now one of the countries with the highest number of people affected by the pandemic. We have not had as much people dying, but unfortunately, the number is increasing. And I think we failed in doing a coordinated effort, especially on things like the way to put forward the exams and the following of the people who were infected. We came in there too late, and I think that was a mistake. Now, the effect of the pandemic, as everywhere, has been devastating in economic terms and in social terms. And we're going back 10, 20, maybe 30 years in what we had advanced in equality and in poverty. And that, of course, is very bad for reconciliation. However, the peace agreement with the FARC, that is irreversible. That will not be affected. But violence and the presence of phenomena like the drug trafficking and the illegal crops will be stimulated by the consequences of the pandemic. So we have to be much more proactive in counteracting those effects.
In your experience, does climate change necessarily lead to more conflicts, or is there a basis to expect greater solidarity and collaboration in the face of a threat multiplier? In other words, can pandemic or climate change really mobilize and be used to our advantage?
Well, unfortunately, we thought that something like the pandemic would help defuse conflicts, but that was not the case. Even the Secretary General of the UN made a call for a ceasefire in all the internal conflicts, and nobody really paid much attention. And climate change, unfortunately, especially because, for example, the migration that climate change produces will increase tensions. And we have to be aware of that and hopefully try to make people understand that a way to avoid or mitigate conflict is also fighting climate change, because the effect is not positive. The effect is negative.
So quickly, we have a few more minutes left. Two real fast questions here I wanted to get in. So you recently joined the Elders Group, a group of independent global leaders committed to working together for peace and human rights. What are your top takeaways, two takeaways from this group, philanthropists who are ready to take on climate change?
Well, first of all, we have to reverse the trend against multilateralism. If we don't cooperate more among countries and within countries, but especially among countries, it's going to be very difficult to address the issues that we are confronting after the pandemic. So that is one specific target. Strengthen multilateralism, strengthen the UN and what the UN represents and wants to achieve. And the second point, which I think is directly concerned with this forum, you were talking about collective action. I am a great believer in the value of collective intelligence and collective action. And the role that the philanthropist can play is a very important role, because the money that and the investments and the programs that are funded by philanthropists are much better received by the communities than the money or the projects that are funded exclusively by governments or by the private sector. There's no political objectives, there's no profit, and usually it's more transparent. So the UN, or what the UN represents, and targeting those areas that are most profitable from the social point of view, fighting poverty, fighting climate change. And of course, the elders have always been advocates of fighting nuclear proliferation, which is one of the big dangers that this world has, unfortunately, still.
So we have maybe about 30 seconds left. I don't know if you can do it in this period of time, but you know, people take so much inspiration from you and what you've been able to accomplish at Columbia when people thought there was a problem that was just impossible to solve. Are there words of encouragement that you can give us as we go out to make a difference and make an impact?
Well, you just mentioned it. Everybody in Colombia and in the region, in Latin America, thought that this war that we had with the oldest and strongest guerrilla for over 50 years could not be ended. And we did. So there's a phrase that has been used very, very often here. We made possible what we thought was impossible. And I am absolutely convinced that every conflict can be solved if you have the correct incentives and you have the correct diagnosis of how to solve those conflicts. There is no conflict that cannot be solved.
I want to thank you, President Santos, for taking the time and for being with us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Philip, and thank you all.
You've been listening to World Affairs. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG and First World Bank, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. This episode was produced by Joanne Jennings, Jared Sport, and me, Teresa Kotsarilis. Temba Daniels and Tatum Sanderbeck provided research assistance. Our music is by Blue Dot Sessions. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. I'm Teresa Kotsarilis, sitting in for Philip Yun. Thanks for listening.